All right, welcome back. This is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome to our new program, Crash, Are You Ready? Today we're scheduled to have a very special guest, Eustace Mullins, world-renowned authority on the Federal Reserve Bank and author of numerous books such as The Secrets of the Federal Reserve and also books on the health issues such as the murder by injection about the dangers of vaccines. I was listening to the news before the program began and heard the discussion about the suspension of habeas corpus in the United States. Let me say this. If you have a suspension of habeas corpus, you're not moving towards a police state. You're already in a police state. So it's academic to talk about losing freedoms when, in fact, you've already lost them. What we're going to talk about today, as soon as we get Eustace on the line, is that the history of this country is basically a history of the forces of freedom battling the international bankers and their debt money system right from the very beginning of our country's existence, from the Revolutionary War right up until the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, when they finally got the debt money system installed as a national, quote-unquote national, which is really a private banking system. We have also Eustace Mullins is one of the only surviving people that actually knew the poet Ezra Pound. Now, Ezra Pound was a contemporary of Ernest Hemingway, and Pound greatly influenced. Many people said he was the number one influence on the literature of his time. He was very interested in the money system, and he began to research the money system, and he understood and discovered the differences between a parasitic debt money system and an organic debt-free money system. He was a strong advocate of a local economy, and indeed, in the Depression, what we see is, that was debt bubble number one. This is debt bubble number two today. What we see in the Depression, any listeners out there know how the local economies survived during the Depression? Have you ever researched it? Has your stockbroker or CPA or financial planner ever told you about it, or is he or she even aware of it? 99% of them, I believe, have no concept of how the communities survived during the Depression. Of course, the Depression was engineered. They planned it that way, contrary to what you hear and read in the mass media. The money masters know very well what they're doing when they create the parameters necessary for a depression. These people are not stupid at all. They know exactly what they're doing. And we have that sequence of events, in my opinion, in debt bubble number two, with the fundamental numbers even worse than they were during the Great Depression. But how the local communities survived is that they issued their own local currencies. And there were dozens, literally dozens, of different kinds of depression script. It wasn't gold or silver that came to the rescue, contrary to what you've been told, in 1933, and prior to 1933, there were all kinds of gold and silver media of exchange. We had gold certificates prior to 1933 in circulation. We had silver certificates. We had silver coinage. We had gold coin. None of it, contrary, if you listen to what most of the hard asset advocates are saying today, there is a place for gold I believe, in everybody's portfolio in the proper, what I believe is the proper form. In fact, I believe that the proper type of gold coin is going to be essential to survive the coming economic collapse. So keep that in mind. However, there are certain things that gold will do and certain things it will not do. It did not, with all the gold coinage in circulation, with all the gold certificates, silver coinage in circulation, it did not prevent the Great Depression. Because it is the money masters that are pulling the strings, it is the money masters that are controlling the money system. And no amount of gold in circulation prevented that crash. Keep that in mind. Most of the people today in the hard asset business are telling you that if we only had something, quote-unquote, backing up the money system, that all of our economic problems would be solved. And what I'm saying is none of the Great Depression was ever prevented by having gold coins in circulation or silver coinage or gold certificates or silver certificates. And in fact, I can prove mathematically to you that the international bankers can literally bankrupt you on a gold standard. And I can prove that mathematically. That's what they don't want you to know. So the way that the local economy survived in the Great Depression, remember, one of the earmarks of a depression is a critical shortage of circulating medium. They issued their own depression script. This was exactly like what the colonies did. Remember, they had their own colonial currency, and they issued their own debt-free, interest-free currency into circulation. Now, when a couple of British representatives took a tour of Philadelphia with Benjamin Franklin, they were astonished at the level of prosperity that they saw. And they asked Ben Franklin, how do you do this? You know, I mean, this is fantastic, but you know, Ben, we want to see all of Philadelphia while we're here. We don't want to just see the good side of town. We want to see the poor houses. And Benjamin Franklin looked them straight in the eye and said, sirs, in the colonies, we do not have any poor houses. And even if we had poor houses, we wouldn't have anybody to put in them. And they said, how do you do that? He said, we issue our own debt-free, interest-free currency into circulation, and we issue it in proportion to the needs of commerce. Back after the break. All right, we're back after the break. This is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome to our new show, Crash, Are You Ready? We now have world-renowned authority on the Federal Reserve Bank and the parasitic debt money system on the line, Eustace Mullins. Eustace, are you there?
Oh, yes. I had a little trouble getting the call through. I don't know what the problem
is. All right. Well, we got through, and we have, I believe, the worst fiscal crisis right now that this country has ever faced. In my opinion, it's probably... the fundamental numbers are probably worse than the Great Depression. How severe do you believe that the coming economic collapse is going to be, and how the heck did we get into this mess?
Well, we got into it through banker manipulation, just like we get into everything. Now, Greenspan said on television on Sunday night that we are going into a recession.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably would know that.
Yeah, that's their statement there.
Yes. And he didn't offer any corrective means to win to guard off the recession, but uh-huh. He just said state that in fact.
Well, he certainly ought to know. I mean, it was the international bankers that set the stage for the collapse. I mean, these people are not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing. Tell our listeners a little bit about the economic history of the debt money system, which has been literally edited out of our college textbooks. I mean, this is never taught today to the financial planners, CEOs, brokers that are giving people retirement advice. How do we get into this?
Well, we got into it as a war measure. You see, the Federal Reserve was passed as a wartime measure. Yeah, the Federal Reserve is a central bank, and the primary function of a central bank is to, war finance. So they set up World War One with Woodrow. They set up World War One by electing President Woodrow Wilson to sign the Federal Reserve Act into law, and so then we went right into World War One by lending Great Britain $400 million, which Great Britain used to get into the war.
Well, isn't that eerily similar to the tactics they're using today? There's a perpetual emergency. There's always some kind of a war, so you need to surrender your constitutional rights because there's a perpetual emergency. So they got us into this Federal Reserve System through the pretext of a national emergency.
Oh, yes.
Obviously that was not the first attempt that the international bankers had made to put us into a parasitic debt money system. Can you tell our listeners about some of the earlier history of our country going back to the Revolutionary War? Did not Benjamin Franklin say something to the effect, we would gladly have borne a tax on tea, that's not why we went to war. We went to war because the Bank of England was trying to install its debt money system into the colonies.
Oh, yes, the Bank of England ran the whole show. And Franklin was perfectly correct. He understood money, and he saw that the Bank of England was simply trying to protect its debt money system.
Well,
and that's been the history of the United States ever since, because after the Revolution, the bankers moved in. They've run everything since.
Is any of this being taught in our colleges today?
Oh, absolutely nothing. Not only not being taught in the colleges, but the business people have no concept of this whatsoever. You know, I've given copies of my Federal Reserve book to bankers for years in this area, and they get absolutely no comprehension whatsoever. It's totally foreign to them.
Well, and you laid a lot of this out in your book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, many years ago.
Yeah, that's a textbook of the whole operation.
I remember, in fact, after the colonists won the Revolutionary War, won their independence, we had a battle going on between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, and Jefferson said, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their money, first by inflation, that's like the Roaring Twenties, then by deflation, that's like the Depression that followed, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until their children will wake up homeless in the continent their fathers conquered. Now, this man, this economist by the name of Thomas Jefferson is never quoted in the economics textbooks today. He was battling Alexander Hamilton. Was Alexander Hamilton a Rothschild agent?
All his life.
I'm sorry?
He never was anything but a Rothschild agent.
He was never anything but a Rothschild agent.
He set up the first bank of the United States, which, of course, was the central bank.
And now,
Jefferson fought that.
And Jefferson fought it, and in the college textbooks today for the CPAs, stockbrokers, financial planners, we never see anything but praise for the National Bank. I remember hearing in one of your tapes that you mentioned that the sole reason for the War of 1812 was that when Thomas Jefferson was president and the charter for the National Bank, a renewal of the charter of the National Bank came up. Thomas Jefferson refused to renew the charter of the National Bank, and you said that was the sole purpose for the War of 1812, and it's never taught in any college textbook today.
It's never mentioned in any history book of any kind.
How many financial advisors realize that today? Well, in the ensuing decades, they kept fighting, and then they finally got the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. Jacob Schiff and Paul Warburg, could you tell our listeners a little bit about how they accomplished this nasty little sequence of events?
Fortune magazine in 1932, the February issue of 1932, gave a great deal of comment to the fact that the Rothschilds had never had any part in American finance. And this is a secret that they kept for many years, because by claiming to have nothing to do in America, they wouldn't do anything financial in this country. They were actually running the whole show through two subsidiary firms, J.P. Morgan Company and Kuhn Loeb Company.
Oh,
boy. And they control all the finance of this country.
All right, we'll be back after the break with Eustace Mullins. All right, we're back after the break with Eustace Mullins. This is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome back to our new program, Crash, Are You Ready? Eustace Mullins is one of the few remaining people who actually knew and worked with Ezra Pound, the poet Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound made quite a lot of discoveries about the money system, and he was a very firm believer in getting the economy to the local level instead of allowing the international bankers to run the entire economy from the central, quote-unquote, central bank. And also Ezra Pound was a very firm believer in the ideas of Douglass and another gentleman by the name of Silvio Gesell. Now, going back to how did these communities survive the Depression, they issued their own Depression script. And I remember years ago seeing a local currency from Mason City, Iowa. And it was fascinating because they were using the ideas of Silvio Gesell, whom Ezra Pound was very fond of, and on the back of this currency, this local currency, there was a stamp. Now, if you didn't spend the money, the idea was to get this money to circulate during the Depression when there was a shortage of circulating medium. If you did not spend this currency within the certain length of time, you had to affix another stamp and pay for another stamp. Now, when I looked at this currency, every single stamp on the back, every single space for a stamp on this currency, which was after Silvio Gesell's ideas, whom Ezra Pound greatly admired, every single stamp was affixed to the back of that currency, which tells me that this currency worked. It circulated as money, and it worked extremely well. Now, Eustace, can you tell us about Ezra Pound's views on the money system?
His views on the monetary system caused him to be indicted by no less than Alger Hiss on a charge of treason, and he was arrested when we went to Italy in 1944 and flown back to Washington. And they was told he would be charged with treason, which is a capital offense. Well, the only problem was that no evidence of any kind whatsoever. Treason consists of giving aid and comfort to the enemy in wartime. And Ezra gave no aid whatsoever to the comfort of Italy during World War II.
Uh-huh.
So they never could try him. And in fact, they called him in, and they said, how will you defend yourself in this trial? And Ezra said, I will stand by everything I ever said over Radio Rome. And they were absolutely floored by that, because the last thing they wanted to do was retreat in court what he had said on Radio Rome during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So they got three psychiatrists, government psychiatrists, to come in and declare him incompetent to participate in his own defense, because his defense was that he would stand by everything he ever said.
And, I remember that Ezra Pound said that if I did not tell the truth about the money system, I would be guilty in the common law of misprison of a felony.
Yeah, he often said that. And that's exactly true. He was doing his duty as a citizen by announcing his knowledge of misprision of a felony.
So I'm not guilty of treason for telling the truth, but I would be guilty of misprison of a felony if I did not expose what the Roosevelt administration and the international bankers were up to. I remember growing up as a Cold War baby, they would always talk about how these political dissidents were declared insane. In other words, they were not insane. They were political dissidents. But a favorite tactic of the communist government was to declare people that were political dissidents to be insane. So this would confuse Joe Sixpack, the common individual, into thinking that they were in fact crazy. You knew Ezra Pound personally. Was he ever crazy, or was he put in the insane asylum because he knew too much?
He knew too much. It was a constant tactic of Joseph Stalin himself.
Uh-huh.
He put his political opponents in the insane asylum. And then everybody would say, well, they're crazy, so we won't believe anything they say. And that was the tactic they used to put Ezra Pound in the insane asylum. But people that went there, including myself, found immediately that he was not insane at all. So it's sort of, he had 3,800 visitors during the 15 years he was in prison there.
Okay, listeners, here you have a first-hand account that we, under the Roosevelt administration in this country, were doing the same things that the communists were doing during the Cold War. So if you think that we have not had political prisoners in this country, think again.
Well, Ezra Pound told me that everybody who was in San Elizabeth was there because somebody wanted them there.
Uh-huh.
And that's really the story.
Now, Ezra Pound was probably the most influential literary figure of his generation, and I believe just about every one of the great writers acknowledges a debt to Ezra Pound. What are your personal recognitions of what are your personal reminiscences of Ezra Pound the person?
Well, he was always a leader, he was always a patriot, and he was a political prisoner, because the charges against him were so flimsy that they never dared try him. So they kept him in an insane asylum for 15 years, and I introduced him to a North Dakota congressman who went on the floor of the House and said, "Why is the government holding this man?" And the government could make no answer, because they had no evidence of any kind against him. So they immediately released him. That's how Ezra got out after people were boasting in Washington that Ezra Pound would never leave St. Elizabeth alive. And they were boasting that when I met him. And then suddenly he dropped all charges and he walked out.
Well, was it that they got too embarrassed? I mean, were too many people?
Oh, they were very embarrassed, because all over the world, people were saying, "Why are you keeping Ezra Pound in prison?" Because this is the most famous writer in the world. Four of his proteges were awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, and Ernest
uh-huh.
Hemingway, who is not a very good writer, but Ezra was able to help him get a couple of books out.
And yet, many more people today know about Ernest Hemingway than they do about Ezra Pound, who was the greatest literary figure of his era.
Oh, yes. There's still pumping up Hemingway's reputation by teaching him in all the colleges. Do you know, Ernest Hemingway still sells 5 million books a year, and I'm sure it's through Ezra's influence.
Well, I can walk into any Borders or Barnes & Noble today, and I'll see Ezra Pound on the shelf. Back after the break with Eustace Mullins. This is George Whitehurst Berry. We're back after the break with our very special guest, Eustace Mullins. We're going to open up this last segment to call-ins. The number for your questions for Eustace or comments is 1-800-259-9231, 1-800-259-9231. You have a rare opportunity here to ask questions of one of the greatest living authorities on the Federal Reserve Bank and the parasitic debt money system, and also of the great poet Ezra Pound. 1-800-259-9231 for your questions or comments. Eustace, I hear a lot of talk about what do we do? I mean, we're in this terrible mess. What do we do? How do we get out of it? And of course, most people, I would say probably 99% of the people in the patriotic community are woefully ignorant of the mechanics of the money system. I know that Ezra Pound was a great advocate he said you have to get the economy on the local, you have to have a strong economy on the local level. And there's a perfect example of how a local economy can be strong on the local level, and that is Ithaca, New York, and they have their own local currency. They've been doing it's not something new. It isn't as if, will this work, will it not work? They've been doing this for years, and they're called Ithaca Hours. Is this the type of thing that Ezra Pound envisioned?
Ezra Pound's favorite subject was local control of local purchasing power. When they moved the purchasing power and monetary system of the United States to Wall Street, they no longer had any local control of purchasing power, and the local people had nothing to say about it. And that's the situation we're in. In World War One, we were actually occupied by foreign power. And we were under enemy occupation all during World War One, and the proof of that is that a triumvirate ruled the United States during World War One, and that was President Woodrow Wilson, whom that Wall Street had picked for the presidency, and his intimate counsel was Colonel Edward House, a Rothschild agent, and so. And then they brought over from London Sir William Wiseman, the head of the British Secret Service. And Sir William Wiseman and Colonel House ran everything in this country during World War One. So we were under enemy occupation. And every military decision, every economic decision, and Paul Warburg was the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve System. And his brother, Max Warburg, was the chief intelligence advisor to Kaiser Wilhelm I, with whom we were at war. So several congressmen brought this up during World War One. Is there any conflict of interest between Max Warburg being the intelligence advisor to the Kaiser? He was also his financial advisor. They said, is there any conflict? It's, he's doing this during wartime. He's an enemy agent. And so immediate an outcry arose in Washington about this was a terrible thing to say about anybody, and that Paul Warburg certainly was not an enemy agent. So but there was quite a bit of comment over this for 2 weeks in the Congress of the United States, and they finally concluded Max Warburg and Paul Warburg were not enemy agents.
And
Colonel House kept running the whole show.
They were not enemy agents, I remember years ago that they got all the mass media got all over Billy Carter because he was doing some promotional activities for Libya, I believe, if I remember correctly, and they got all over him as for being an unregistered foreign agent. They wanted him to register. So you have people working for the money masters, and they don't have to register as foreign agents working for a foreign power?
Oh, they never register. This country has been run by unregistered foreign agents. Look at the state of Israel. Israel has 600 people in Washington today are all unregistered enemy agents. And they're the most powerful people in Washington.
We're in this mess. I believe that we're in the beginning stages of probably the biggest financial collapse in the history of this country. Have we already lost the battle? Is it too late to do anything to rectify the situation? Or, in other words, at this point, it seems that, 95% of the American public is so dumbed down that as far as I can see, this coming collapse is inevitable. What is your opinion on, have we already lost our economic freedom, or is there anything we can do at this point?
We've lost our economic freedom, but we've always lost that anyway. We never had it, so that's no problem. I have lectured all over this country in the last 50 years, and I've told everywhere that America is just beginning to fulfill its promise. We're still the greatest nation in the world, and our future is ahead of us, because we haven't even started to be a real country yet. And the American people are completely untouched by all this mass propaganda. It doesn't even get through to them. And because they control the television and newspapers, and we get the State of Israel propaganda 24 hours a day, but people just don't pay attention to it anymore. And so I think the country's in great shape.
Well, as far as I can see, we're in the terminal stages of the world's most gigantic Ponzi or pyramid scheme.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the idea of the pyramid scheme. That's all it ever has been. That's what you have with fake money, occupation money.
How severe do you think that the real estate crash is going to be?
We're all experiencing it at first time. It's not too serious at all. There's a rollback in the real estate prices, but that was overextended. It's really what you'd call in the stock market a correction. You're getting a real estate correction because too many people are buying $5 million houses that were actually worth $50,000. And when you have that greater disparity, it's going to show up somewhere. And now it's showing up everywhere.
Okay. I believe these people knew what they were doing in the final stages of the orgy of buying. They took off all restrictions, and they made loans to people who should never have gotten loans, and the sheer magnitude of this subprime crisis is $1.8 trillion. I believe that's enough to potentially collapse the entire economy. What is your opinion on that?
It could potentially collapse the economy if everybody was called in on all the loans, but the fact is they won't do that because that would be counterproductive. As long as they keep the pyramid scheme going and getting the money from it, they'll keep it going.
Well, yeah, but a Ponzi scheme has a finite lifespan. Mechanically, a Ponzi scheme must collapse because they cannot run a pyramid scheme forever. It's mathematically impossible.
Well, that's absolutely true. I predicted when I wrote my Federal Reserve book in 1953 that the Federal Reserve scam was intended to last only 25 years because they figured they couldn't get away with it longer than 25 years. And they've been keeping it going ever since.
Well, the first debt bubble culminated with the Great Depression. I believe this debt bubble is going to make the Great Depression look like child's play. Thank you, Eustace, and it's a pleasure to have you. We'll be back again Monday. Welcome back, Monday. Welcome back again to our new show, Crash, Are You Ready? This is George Whitehurst Berry. We have a distinguished guest today, Eustace Mullins, whom we had on previously a few days ago, talking about the money system and the Federal Reserve Bank. Of course, Eustace is the author of numerous books, such as The Secrets of the Federal Reserve and also Murder by Injection, etc., etc. So we have a situation today where a lot more Americans are becoming increasingly interested in what they call what is called alternative medicine. It's kind of interesting that the type of medicine which relies on herbs and traditional remedies, which has been practiced for thousands of years, is called alternative medicine, whereas the relatively new type of allopathic medicine, if you will, which relies on heavily on drugs, is called traditional medicine. It's kind of interesting how that's been reversed. But in any case, I want to do kind of a standard disclaimer on any of our health topics. Neither I nor Eustace nor any other guest on this program now or in the future does any diagnosing or prescribing. You have to go to a competent and licensed health professional. So with that in mind, we're going to discuss today things like the topics such as the hidden dangers of vaccines, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Now, it's Eustace, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm there.
All right. Well, I notice a lot of publicity, increasing publicity, is being given to the fact that, for example, in the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, a lot of times the regulators might have been sitting as a prominent corporate member, for example, perhaps they were on the board of directors of one of the major drug companies, which the FDA is supposed to regulate. So I noticed these kinds of curious connections. And then, of course, I personally have never taken a flu shot. And I understand in many of the flu shots, which they, in the mass media, they say it's just a routine thing, they have mercury and other things which many publications are suggesting are highly toxic. Then I notice things like some of the major companies which purchase beef in large quantities wanted to do their own testing for mad cow disease, and the regulatory body, which is the Department of Agriculture, fought it tooth and nail. Again, wouldn't the regulators be only too happy to have companies doing additional testing to prevent possible contamination with things like mad cow disease. So we have these curious connections where a lot of things really don't make too much sense. Are the people in the regulatory bodies such as the FDA and the Department of Agriculture, USDA, are they really looking out for us, or are they looking out for the interests of the drug companies and so forth?
Oh no, the FDA is purely a pharmaceutical operation, and they invented the revolving door, and it's not that simply that the people at FDA go back and forth between jobs at the pharmaceutical industry. It's a revolving door. They go back and forth. They work for FDA for 3 years, and then they'll go to Merck for 3 years, and then they'll come back to FDA for 3 years. So they maintain all the contacts.
Well, how can the people who are sitting in prominent corporate positions in the major drug companies be totally neutral and unbiased when they put on the hat as a regulator?
Well, they're not neutral at all. They're profit oriented for the pharmaceutical industries. And in my book, Murder by Injection, I chronicled the 18 largest drug companies in the world, and every one of them had a revolving door to FDA. And I illustrated it by telling what positions they had at FDA and what positions they had at Merck. So there's no conflict of interest there whatsoever.
Okay. It's kind of interesting that in the past few years that many, many more Americans have become dissatisfied with just the allopathic approach, and the word allopathic or allopath means like the opposite cures like. So I remember seeing a book which was written around 1913, and it was a general, like one of these general family health books, and it had you know, kind of a Reader's Digest type general health topics for the average American citizen. It was written in plain English, nothing technical. But in the front of the book, they had pictures of these colleges, and they weren't allopathic colleges. They were gigantic homeopathic colleges in places like Chicago. And then once I saw that book, I did some more research, and I found out that the United States, prior to in the early part of the century, had the largest amount of homeopathic colleges in the world. And so how, by the way, the word homeopathic means like cures like, as opposed to allopathic, which means opposite cures like. How did we get from the point where we had years ago so many different choices as to what kind of health care the American people could choose themselves, what approach they preferred? How do we get to the point where we were almost exclusively allopathic, and now it seems like in the past few years, for example, Arizona is one of the states that now licenses naturopathic doctors? How did we get to an almost exclusively allopathic approach, and then today it seems like the what they call alternative medicine is again gaining ground? How do we get to that point where almost all other approaches other than the allopathic approach were eliminated from the health choices that Americans had?
Well, that's completely explained in my book, Murder by Injection. There was a revolution, and the revolutionary was no less than John D. Rockefeller. See, John D. Rockefeller got the Federal Reserve Act through in 1913.
All right, we'll take that up. We'll take that topic up back after the break. Interesting how the money power behind the scenes can stifle Americans' choices. Back after the break. All right, We're back after the break with Eustace Mullins. This is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome back to our new show, Crash, Are You Ready? So before we went into the break, Eustace was talking about how we had all different kinds of freedom of choice in this country. Americans could choose what medical approach they wanted. And then along comes the money power. And it's interesting how these things intertwine. Eustace, of course, is the author of Secrets of the Federal Reserve, as well as Murder by Injection. It's interesting how the parasitic debt money system of the Federal Reserve Bank crosses over into these other areas, and these such as the health field. Now, what happened, Eustace, when the money power came into play?
Well, they set up a monopoly because that's the only thing they believe in is monopoly. And so they simply took over the entire medical practice in this country, lock, stock, and barrel, and they turned it into monopoly. They closed down all the medical schools to have a less number of doctors.
All those gigantic colleges that I saw in this book, such as the truly, truly massive complex of buildings, which was a homeopathic college. I believe it was in Chicago. It's been several years since I saw the book. All of these colleges were closed down.
Oh, yes. They were shut down just like the crash because they were gone. And they were a thriving industry. And, you know, after I got out my book, Murder by Injection, many of those homeopathic colleges are still existing in Dallas, Chicago, and Fort Worth, and various places, and they started ordering cases of my book, Murder by Injection. So they're still going, and I met many of them. I traveled around the country and met them. They're very sincere people, hardworking people, and they had good practices.
So some of them did not, in fact, shut down, but the scale of activity was greatly diminished.
Oh, they were greatly reduced. I would say they reduced to about 10% of their previous operations.
So they lost 90% of the scope of their operations.
Oh, absolutely.
Was this about money? Because with an allopathic approach, they can charge more?
It was more political. It's pure political. John D. Rockefeller took over all the state governments and local governments in the United States, and he set up regulations for the hospital industry. And so all that has been, you know, was tightly controlled by the state legislature, and they set up conditions that the homeopathic colleges could meet, and stringent new regulations. And they've spent a lot of money to stay in business. So that's how he did it.
Mm-hmm. So basically they took over virtually control of most of the medical establishment. And then through the mass media, there was a massive propaganda campaign stating that basically the only valid approach was the allopathic approach. How did they go about brainwashing the American people?
Well, they did it through reform. You see, that is how John D. Rockefeller got the Federal Reserve Act through. They called it banking reform. And the banking reform was that Wall Street set up the Federal Reserve System as the monopoly. And they did the same with the hospital industry.
They did the same thing with the medical industry that they did with the money system.
Oh,
basically.
Yes, because the same procedures and regulations that they controlled the banking industry with were also the same medical regulations. They controlled all the hospitals and all the medical practice in the United States. And those regulations are in effect today. They're very stringent, and new ones are being put through the legislatures every day.
So basically they took over control of most of the medical establishment. And then through the mass media, there was a massive propaganda campaign stating that basically the only valid approach was the allopathic approach. How did they go about brainwashing the American people?
Well, they did it through reform, you see. That is how John D. Rockefeller got the Federal Reserve Act through. They called it banking reform. And the banking reform was that Wall Street set up the Federal Reserve System as the monopoly. And they did the same with the hospital industry.
They did the same thing with the medical industry that they did with the money system.
Oh,
basically.
Yeah, because the same procedures and regulations that they controlled the banking industry with were also the same medical regulations. They controlled all the hospitals and all the medical practice in the United States. And those regulations are in effect today. They're very stringent, and new ones are being put through the legislatures every day.
Eustace, now you've authored many books. How can people purchase your books and your material?
Well, I still have my books in print, and they can be purchased through me. I'm at the Christian Retirement Home in Stewartstown, Virginia.
Okay, is there an address to or an email address to contact for people that want?
It's not on email, but it's 94 Mountain Vista Drive.
Okay, now let's make sure we have this. Okay, so it's to your attention, and then the Christian Retirement Home?
Yes, Christian Retirement Home, apartment 101. And everything that comes from our private apartment here.
Okay, so Christian Retirement Home, apartment 101.
And then Stewartstown, Virginia.
How do you spell the city?
It's like Jeb Stuart, the Confederate general.
Okay.
Stewartstown. And draft means a stream. Stewartstown, Virginia.
Well, this is coming out. It's kind of difficult to understand on the radio. So let's spell it out for our listeners to make sure they have it.
All right.
S-T-U-A-R-T-S. Okay, and then the second word is.
Is a draft, like draft beer.
Like grass, G-R-A-S-S.
D-R-A-F-T. D-R-A-F-T.
Draft,
like a draft beer.
Like a draft, a draft of wind or something?
Oh, yes.
Draft, okay. D-R-A, like Bush is probably going to have to reinstitute the draft. Is that the word?
Well, that's coming, yes.
Okay,
got to get some soldiers from somewhere.
There you go. All right, so Stewart's Draft, S-T-U-A-R-T, apostrophe S, draft, and that's in Virginia?
Yeah, V-A.
And
zip code is 24477.
Okay, so.
And I can even give you my phone number if you like.
All right.
It's 540-932-8731.
Okay, so if you want to write Eustace and order some of his books, you write to Christian Retirement Home, apartment 101, Stewart's Draft. That's S-T-U-A-R-T, apostrophe S, draft, D-R-A-F-T, Virginia, 24477. And if you want to call Eustace for his books and material, the number is 540-932-8731. So, Eustace, we were talking about the takeover of the health system by the money power and how the takeover paralleled the Federal Reserve the implementation of the Federal Reserve Bank in the sense that both were monopolies. And we'll continue with this topic after the break. All right, this is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome back to our new show, Crash, Are You Ready? We have a distinguished guest today, Eustace Mullins. Eustace, which of your books are available and what is the cost?
Oh, I have the Murder by Injection and the Federal Reserve System and A Writ for Martyrs and The Rape of Justice. That's a textbook on American law.
Mm-hmm.
And then my biography of Ezra Pound is still out of print. I have some other books out of print. My Life in Christ, I've let that out of print. I'm going to get those back in print as soon as possible.
All right. So what are the cost on the ones that are available?
Well, these are all very deluxe hardcover books, and they're $45 a copy.
It's $45 a copy?
Yeah, that's postpaid.
Okay.
All expenses included.
I think they're probably going for about twice or three times that on eBay, man. Now, maybe some people don't know that you're still selling the books.
Well, that's true, they don't.
I've actually seen them go for quite a bit of money on the eBay auction. So it's good to be able to purchase directly from you. And this is information which is not readily available in the mass media. And I'm sure you would be happy to autograph the books for our listeners as well.
Yes, autograph all books I send out to listeners. And I'm glad to do that because that makes it more personal.
Absolutely. Well, this is a situation where you're getting from the author information which in many cases is not available anywhere else. And once again, that for writing Eustace for purchasing his books. The address is Christian Retirement Home, apartment 101. That's Stuart's Draft, Stuart, apostrophe S, Draft, Draft, Virginia, 24477. And the phone number for Eustace is 540-932-8731. So in your years of research, Eustace, how did you, in other words, what I'm picking up here is that you got on the trail of something, and once you got on the trail of it, you were like a bloodhound. You got on the trail, and you didn't stop until you'd uncovered what was going on behind the scenes. How did you come to do the research on these topics? What initially gave you an idea that things were not necessarily as they might seem on the surface?
Well, I went to visit a patient in an insane asylum, St. Elizabeth Hospital in Washington, D.C., and he had been arrested on no evidence and was never tried, but they put him in St. Elizabeth Hospital on a life sentence, and I managed to get him out later on through a congressman, but Ezra Pound commissioned me to write these books.
So
he said, "I want you to write a book about the Federal Reserve System," and he actually paid me to do it. And I did all of my research at the Library of Congress from official government documents. I mean, there's no rumors and no fantasy in anything I've ever written. And anybody else can go to the Library of Congress and see the original government documents there and check it out for themselves if they want to.
Well, that's an interesting point you brought up, Eustace, because if you walk into a bookstore, anybody, and just you read historical topics or research topics on political events, 95, in my opinion, 95% to 98% of that writing, those people are just copyists. In other words, they're not relying on primary sources.
Oh, no, it's just plagiarism, usually. It's all the pure plagiarism. And the biggest book publisher in the United States is the Central Intelligence Agency. They have eight publishing firms which put out government propaganda. But you never know it's propaganda.
So the initial spark that motivated you to do this research was, in fact, the poet Ezra Pound.
That's exactly right. And Ezra Pound fought for America during World War II, and he broadcast to the American people that they should not go into World War II, as Joe was just another banker's war. And for making those statements, Alger Hiss had him indicted by Franklin D. Roosevelt for high treason, giving aid and comfort to the enemy in wartime.
And of course, so in other words, Ezra Pound was doing broadcast exposing how the money power manipulates us into war, and then Roosevelt wanted to have him put on trial for treason, essentially for telling the truth.
Oh, yes. He was indicted by the Attorney General, who was Nicholas Biddle of the famous banking family. And I went to Biddle's house and drank some of his liquor.
Okay, could you repeat that? Because on the air, it kind of broke up there, the last couple sentences.
I said the Attorney General indicted Ezra Pound for high treason in wartime.
And that attempt to convict obviously fell apart, and so Roosevelt's
crime. That's one case the Justice Department never even dared to try because they had no evidence whatsoever.
Well, then, as a Cold War baby, I remember reading about how the Soviets would take political dissidents and put them into insane asylums, so Joe Sixpack or the average public would not know the difference. So they weren't insane. In other words, they were put into an insane asylum because they were essentially political prisoners, and they were saying or doing things that would be contrary to what the money masters or the authorities wanted. So instead of actually trying them on the merits, they would stick them into an insane asylum, even though they were perfectly sane. In your opinion, is this what happened at Ezra Pound?
Oh, yes. He was committed to St. Elizabeth by five government psychiatrists who all examined him and said that he was incompetent. They declared him incompetent because they asked him how he would defend himself in this trial. And he said, I will say everything that I ever said over the radio. That's how I'm going to defend myself. And so they were thunderstruck at that because they didn't want him to be repeating all the things he said over the radio to the whole American people in the courtroom.
Well, then, as a Cold War baby, I remember reading about how the Soviets would take political dissidents and put them into insane asylums, so Joe Sixpack or the average public would not know the difference. So they weren't insane. In other words, they were put into an insane asylum because they were essentially political prisoners, and they were saying or doing things that would be contrary to what the money masters or the authorities wanted. So instead of actually trying them on the merits, they would stick them into an insane asylum, even though they were perfectly sane. In your opinion, is this what happened at Ezra Pound?
Oh, yes. He was committed to St. Elizabeth by five government psychiatrists who all examined him and said that he was incompetent. They declared him incompetent because they asked him how he would defend himself in this trial. And he said, I will say everything that I ever said over the radio. That's how I'm going to defend myself. And so they were thunderstruck at that because they didn't want him to be repeating all the things he said over the radio to the whole American people in the courtroom.
So in other words, he said, I'm going to tell the truth again, just like he did on the radio programs.
Yes, he was just being Ezra Pound because the kind of person he was. He never told a lie in his life. He never fooled anybody in his life. And so he said, I'll just go on being Ezra Pound, and that's how I'll defend myself. So they didn't want that defense. They spent millions of dollars. The FBI brought people from Italy who had seen him make the broadcast, and with that they were going to put him away for life. But they never
All
had
right.
to try him.
We will be back after the break with Eustace Mullins. We'll be right back. All right, we're back after the break with Eustace Mullins. This is George Whitehurst. Very welcome back to our show. Crash, are you ready? Before we went into the break, we were talking about the poet Ezra Pound. Now, that great, wonderful humanitarian, Franklin Roosevelt, it has now come out, even in mainstream books such as John Tolan's Infamy about Pearl Harbor, we had already broken the Japanese codes. Roosevelt, who ran on a peace platform, immediately started warmongering all over Europe. He actually had American ships firing on German submarines, and the Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz had standing orders not to respond. So this went on for months, and Roosevelt was unable to provoke an incident, so he could not get us in, as it were, into the war through the front door. So then he attempted to get us in through the back door, that is, through Japan. He put an economic blockade around Japan, and it has now come out. Yeah, the truth will eventually come out. It has now come out that this great, wonderful humanitarian, Franklin D. Roosevelt, actually knew in advance that the Japanese fleet was on the way to bomb Pearl Harbor. Because he wanted us in the war, he sacrificed those men and refused to warn them about the fact that the Japanese fleet was on its way. So you have the same wonderful humanitarian, Franklin Roosevelt, using the typical Soviet tactic of taking political dissidents and putting them into insane asylums in order to confuse the mind of Joe Sixpack. As Eustace said, this was exactly what happened to Ezra Pound. Now, Ezra simply told the truth in his radio broadcast about how the money masters had manipulated us into previous wars and into World War II as well. And for telling the truth, he was put into the insane asylum. That if you think in this country that we have not had or do not have political prisoners, think again. One of the differences when I was growing up as a Cold War baby, our side, the free world, was supposed to have no political prisoners. Well, think again. So I want to open up this final segment to callers. If you have questions or comments for Eustace, the number to call is 1-800-259-9231, 1-800-259-9231. So, Eustace, could you tell us a little bit about how Roosevelt manipulated us into World War II?
Well, Pearl Harbor was the worst-kept secret in American history. You see, as the Japanese proceeded through the Pacific to attack Pearl Harbor, the radio stations in California, which is a very heavily settled area, were picking up all the broadcasts of the Japanese radio. And so they were wondering what is going on. Well, the Japanese were simply on their way to attack Pearl Harbor. That's all that was going on. And everybody on the West Coast knew it, but of course Roosevelt didn't know it. And so it was the worst kept secret, because it's unusual to broadcast on public radio a secret attack on a military objective.
Could Roosevelt have warned the people in Pearl Harbor and reduced American casualties, in your opinion, if he had chosen to do so?
Oh, he could have done that at any time.
And because he already knew.
Because he already knew, except Admiral Kimmel and General Short, his commanders in Pearl Harbor. They were deliberately kept from the information that was Roosevelt was getting every day that the Japanese were on the way to attack Pearl Harbor. But Kimmel and Short were court-martialed after the war on three separate hearings for dereliction of duty, because they didn't listen to the radio and didn't know that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked.
So first Roosevelt refuses to warn them.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that the Japanese fleet is on its way, because we have already broken the Japanese codes, then, in the height of cynicism, has these people prosecuted for dereliction of duty.
Oh, yes, they were all prosecuted, and they're still in disgrace. They have never been cleared of those charges. They're still guilty today. I know Admiral Kimmel his grandson, and he tried to get the great George Bush, first President George Bush, to drop the charges against his grandfather. But George Bush notified Kimmel. He said, "I cannot rewrite history.
I cannot rewrite history.
I cannot rewrite it." Well, they were making history. I don't know why they couldn't rewrite it.
Well, it seems as if Americans have been led into war after war, not based on the truth, but based on a pack of lies.
Yes, I ought to write a book on that. America's wartime history is an absolute revelation of double-dealing and conspiracy that there's not no history in the world.
What is the difference between the truth and the pack of lies that's coming out in the mass media now about Iran?
Oh, well, Iran is the same thing. The presidential candidates are all saying they're going. Their whole program is to attack Iran because that's what Israel has commanded them to do, and that's the only program they have.
Well, I heard or read somewhere that Ahmadinejad never actually said, made a statement about wiping Israel off the map, because that phrase does not even translate from Farsi. And then not only that, but he was also misquoted. And according to Seymour Hersh, the journalist who writes for The New Yorker, Seymour Hersh says Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons, so I don't think anybody would be stupid enough to try actually to wipe Israel off the map. It sounds like, and then at the same time, it sounds like Iran is years away from any nuclear weapon at all if they were actually trying to build one in the first place. Israel has never signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and I believe Iran has. We have some callers here. We have several callers. Let's go to Art in California.
Yo.
Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Oh,
okay.
I'm fine, thanks.
We're running very short on time.
I just want to make a quick comment on Operation Top Off. Do you think it's going to be followed by an actual event?
Operation Top Off?
Operation Top Off.
Oh, Top Off? But what is
Art in California, what is Operation Cop Out?
Operation Top Off is a full-scale, rigorous response to a coordinated terrorist attack.
Okay, so you're talking about these quote-unquote anti-terrorist drills that they're initiating now in the United States?
That's affirmative. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on an actual event following this full-scale exercise. They're saying 15th to the 19th.
Well, Michael Chertoff, the director of Homeland Security, I don't think he has any plan to fight back a terrorist attack. There never has been one.
2005 over in London, they had those drills at the same time the actual event happened, and on 9/11 here in the States.
Oh, yeah, those are all planned exercises.
All right, we're running very short on time here. Thank you for the call. All right, let's go to Paula in Florida. Paula, are you there?
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I've been listening to your program, and I'm going to tell you something. This war, you know who's behind all this? It's Israel.
A war for Israel.
Yeah, they want us out of the picture. They want the whole Middle East for themselves.
Well, their government has announced the program of wiping out all Arabs in the Middle East. That's their goal. And
all right,
nothing left to do.
We're out of time here. Thank you, Eustace Mullins, for another very interesting and informative program. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody, but we're out of time. We'll be back tomorrow with Greg Ciola from the Crusader talking about alternative health topics and the importance of the pH, alkalinity versus acidity in the blood. Until tomorrow. Welcome back to another special edition of Crash. Are you ready? Today we have a very distinguished guest, backed by popular demand, Eustace Mullins, the author of The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, which in my opinion is head and shoulders above the other reserve publications, which might be more popular, but really don't get the facts as well as this book does. Eustace, welcome back to the program. All right, Eustace, can you hear us right now?
Pardon?
Oh, you're online? Okay. Welcome back to our program. And
I switched to the other phone. I have a smaller phone that doesn't work very well.
I can hear you okay on the phone.
Oh, yeah, this is a good phone.
Okay. All right, excellent. I was just looking at your excellent book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, in which you detail interest not only how the Federal Reserve was formed, but how they've gotten us into war after war. Specifically, there's a chapter on World War I. So what Bush has been doing with getting us into wars with Iraq at the behest of the international bankers is nothing new. Ever since the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, they've been setting about getting us into wars. Could you tell our listening audience exactly what the international bankers did to sucker us into World War One?
Well, they didn't really sucker us into World War One. But they're willing to pay for it with that money, of course.
Okay.
And we have been almost continuously in war since the Federal Reserve Act was passed in December 1913. So you'd think the people would finally wake up. Now, I officially call the Federal Reserve Bank the Federal Reserve War Party, because that's all. It is not a Federal Reserve Bank. It's a war party.
Okay, some of the literature I've read at the time, the international banking families have massive control, or if it's blocks of stock, they have the dominant shares of stock of the major news media. And what I was referring to when I said sucker us into World War One, there was a massive propaganda campaign, and what I've read about what the press was saying at the time before we entered the war, it was eerily similar to the bogus charges that were being made about Iraq before with the mass media cranking up either accepting the administration's official line, really questioning it, or manufacturing, just making things up. There was an eerie similarity between the disinformation that led up to the attack on Iraq and the disinformation which the mass media was promulgating among the American public, leading us into World War One. And in both cases, the corporate press, as opposed to the free press, was ultimately, if you look at your excellent book and you follow the interlocking directorates up the ladder, they come to the same banking families.
Oh, they always do. It's the same principal characters, and they're worldwide, and they're united, and so they can go into any country.
All right. Now, exactly who were the principal personalities? In other words, who were the Paul Wolfel?
Well, the Federal Reserve Plan was suggested by Paul Warburg, who was an employee of the Rothschild Bank in Europe. And Paul Warburg became known as the author of the Federal Reserve.
All right, and how did funding occur to get America to enter the war in the First World War? What were the manipulations behind the scenes that led up to our entry into that war?
Well, it was very fortuitous of it. Fortuitous event. Germany and Britain were at war, and Britain was constantly shipping munitions back and forth over around Europe. And so they loaded a ship, the Lusitania, with 40,000 tons of munitions, and then notified the Germans just where it would be sailing on a certain date. And so the Germans obligingly sunk the Lusitania, and there was some loss of American life. And so Woodrow Wilson, an employee of the National City Bank of New York, promptly voted us into the war.
I believe I read somewhere that something like 85% of the American public, before the massive propaganda campaigns began by the corporate press to get us into that war, something like 85% of the people were opposed to entering the European wars. This is, you know, before we got into World War I.
Well, they always are. They were all opposed to entering the Iraq war. The people always 80% opposed to war because they know that their sons are going to get killed.
Well, they were also, they had paid attention to the founders of our country, like George Washington, who in his farewell address said, do not get involved in the entanglements of wars in Europe.
Well, foreign entanglements, that's what he said. And that's absolutely true. Because this country was young and needed to develop and had no business getting involved in foreign entanglements.
Well, we have a situation apparently where the American people, the vast majority of the American people, have not learned the lessons of what has happened in Iraq. Apparently, they're using the same nuclear weapons argument that if we don't attack Iran now, it's the same thing they said. Of course, then Iraq had no nuclear weapons, and of course, neither does Iran. But the interesting thing is, after it has been documented that the reasons we went into Iraq were bogus, they're using exactly the same arguments about Iran, and the American people didn't learn a thing from it, or the vast majority of them didn't learn anything from the previous set of lies. Back after the break. All right, we're back with our special guest, Eustace Mullins, the author of The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. Eustace, there is another chapter in your book about the Great Depression. What connection did the international bankers have, or the Federal Reserve Bank have, with engineering the Great Depression?
Well, the international bankers are really the central bankers. A central bank is a conglomerate of banks that can operate all over the world. So what happened in 1928, the gold dealers, the international gold dealers, the Warburgs and Rothschilds, they wanted to get Great Britain back on the gold standard. And so the United States embarked on a massive financial campaign to help Great Britain get back on the gold standard. This was revealed in the congressional investigations of the crash of 29, but never read the papers. And my book is the only one that revealed it. And so they deliberately manipulated the crash of 29. The country was prosperous, and there was no reason for a depression. But the bankers, with their worldwide operations, could operate anywhere in the world. So they went into Wall Street and raised the short-term loan, and people couldn't meet their payments, and so that caused the crash.
All right. This is, we have in the series of programs we've had here, I've said many, many times, prior to 1933, we had in this country, we had gold certificates, we had silver certificates, we had gold coin, we had silver coin, and there are so many people out there that are saying, well, if we just had something, quote-unquote, backing up the money supply, that all of our financial problems would be over. And then I'll ask them the question, did having gold coinage, gold certificates, silver certificates prior to 1933, did any of that prevent the crash of 1929? Of course it did not. Did any of those things prevent the depression that followed with more than 5,000 bank failures? Of course it didn't. Now, in your book here, there's a perfect example, and I've said repeatedly that international bankers can bankrupt you on a gold standard, they can bankrupt a country on a gold standard just as easily as they can on a non-gold standard. Now, here in your book is yet another proof, because it says right here in under the chapter of the Great Depression, and on page 143, the League of Nations had achieved its goal of getting the nations of Europe back on the gold standard by 1928, but three-fourths of the world's gold was in France and the United States. The problem was how to get the gold to currency, which needed it as a basis for money and credit. The answer was action by the Federal Reserve System. Of course, as they were effecting the transfer of gold out of this country and over into Europe, they were creating the basis for a depression over here. So here's a perfect example. It says in your book on page 144, following the secret meeting of the Federal Reserve Board and the heads of the foreign central banks in 1927, the Federal Reserve banks in a few months doubled. Exportation of $500 million in gold that year. The system's market activities forced the rates of call money down on the stock exchange and forced gold out of the country. Foreigners also took this opportunity to purchase heavily in government securities because of the low call money rate. Quote, the agreement between the Bank of England and the Washington Federal Reserve authorities many months ago was that we would force the export of $725 million of gold by reducing the bank rates here, thus helping the stabilization of France and Europe and putting France on a gold basis. And I might add, thus engineering the depression in this country. So there's a perfect example in your book. It's documented how the international bankers created the depression by moving or causing gold to be moved out of this country.
It is a perfect example, and it shows the manipulation of international gold movements, but an essential part of the central bank operations there was.
So, in other words, it appears that the vast majority of the American people have not learned a thing from what happened in the money manipulations to create the Great Depression over here. It's like they never have learned a lesson that is demonstrated here in your book. Here it is in black and white. This is a perfect example of how the international bankers created depression sent on a gold standard simply by manipulating the call rates and manipulating the movement of the gold to another.
In your book, manipulation.
Well, your book is one of the only ones that documents this. I mean, there are many books which are out there which are, you know, possibly more popular, but they have some facts about, like, who the people were that met in Jekyll Island and how they got aboard a train.
Well, it's all out of my book. See, I wrote my book in 1953, and it's been circulating for 50 years, but the American people have never paid much attention to it.
Well, that's exactly, and the thing is, there are other books out there which are much more widely read about the Federal Reserve. Now, some of them will have a lot of details about who the chief players were that met boarded a train in Hoboken, New Jersey, how they went down and met in secret in Jekyll Island, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in other words, there are many names and dates and faces and places, but when it comes down to the actual mechanism of how depressions are created, they have either a lot of disinformation or they don't even address the issue at all. It's astonishing. And at the same time, you have thousands of copies of these kind of books, which in my opinion, in many cases, help the international bankers by throwing up a smokescreen. If you have some facts and then you mix them in with some disinformation, it's much more difficult for the average person to disentangle that than it is if you just had 100% disinformation. And now with your book, you've got accurate facts. And a lot of people, I saw one of your books on the antiquarian book listings selling for more than $300, and yet your books are still in print and the public doesn't know how to get them. So after the break, we'll come back and I'd like you to give your address where people can order your books. Back after the break, you use the small. All right, we're back with our distinguished guest, Eustace Mullins. Eustace, I notice now on page 162 of your book, you have the testimony before the House Banking and Currency Committee on June 24th, 1941, of Governor Mariner Eccles. And he says, money is created out of the right to issue credit money, quote unquote. Now, if you or I write a check and we don't have sufficient funds in our bank accounts to cover that check, they call that a crime and they call that check kiting. And yet here is an individual before the House Banking and Currency Committee openly admitting that the money that the Federal Reserve Bank creates is created as a bookkeeping entry out of nothing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But the catch to it all is that the Federal Reserve Act was passed to give Congress the authority to authorize this creating money out of nothing. Actually, it would be illegal because the Constitution reserves that right to Congress. But a central bank, first of all, is a bank which has the right of issue, which obtains the right to print money, a magic money machine. And that is what all of the fuss is about the Federal Reserve System, because it is a scam. Essentially, it's actually counterfeit money, but it's counterfeit money which is issued with the authority of the U.S. government. And the Federal Reserve money immediately becomes a full obligation of the U.S. government. And that's how they got it through Congress in 1913. Now, they got the bill through Congress because they had to offer a little enticement. And so what they did to persuade Congress to pass the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, they said the Federal Reserve will pay all of its profits into the U.S. Treasury. But they didn't tell anyone that they'd also put a clause in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 which abolished the United States Treasury and said the United States Treasury is no longer the sole fiscal agent of the United States government. It, from now on, it's going to be the Federal Reserve Bank. In other words, a private-owned bank. And so nobody has ever read that sentence in the Federal Reserve System. And, see, the congressmen voted for the Federal Reserve Act in 1913 because they said, we're going to give all our profits to the U.S. Treasury. Well, that sounded very patriotic. But what they did, the Federal Reserve kept all the profits, and they used it as a war fund. And we've been fighting these wars ever since because they're financing these wars with the profits of the private-owned Federal Reserve System.
Oh, okay,
I was going to give you my address that the people can order up-to-date copies of my Federal Reserve book directly from me at the Christian Retirement Home.
Now, what is the price of the book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve?
It's $40 postpaid.
Okay. All right, so that includes the shipping then. And how
shipping
can our listeners get... What address should the listeners write to order your book?
Christian Retirement Home, 94 Mountain Vista.
Christian Retirement Fund.
A home, H-O-M-E.
I want to make sure we get this. Christian Retirement Fund.
Home.
Christian and then what is,
home. 94.
What is the... I'm sorry, Houston.
It's a Christian Retirement Home.
Christian Retirement Home, okay. H-O-M-E.
Yeah.
And then address, what is...
94 Mountain Vista Drive.
How do you spell that?
M-O-U-N-T-A-N Vista, V-I-S-T-A, Drive, D-R. And it's apartment 101. Stewart's Draft, Virginia, 24477. And
okay, could you give that once again for us, Eustace? Could you give out that address once again for us,
yes.
Please?
The Christian Retirement Home, 94 Mountain Vista Drive, apartment 101, Stewart's Draft, Virginia. It's two words. Draft 24477.
Okay, let me make sure I got this correct. You were breaking up a bit on the transmission there, but I've got Christian Retirement Home, and that's 94 Mountain Vista Drive, and that's apartment 101, and that
two words, Stewart's Draft. Virginia.
How do you spell that?
Stewart is a lot of Scott's name Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T-S, and draft is a, it's like draft beer, and then VA, Virginia, and the zip is 24477.
Okay. What I have here is, Christian Retirement Home, and then 94 Mountain Vista Drive, apartment 101. And I, because you're breaking up on the air there, what is the city again, please?
Stewart Draft. That's the last name Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T-S, and that second word is draft, which is like draft beer.
Okay.
And VA for Virginia.
Okay. Let me repeat this. S-T-U-A-R-T-S. And then another word. First word is Stewart's, and then the second word is draft, like draft beer, D-R-A-F-T?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So Stewart's Draft, Virginia, 24477. So
there.
Okay, so Christian Retirement Home, 94 Mountain Vista Drive, apartment 101, Stewart's Draft, S-T-U-A-R-T-S-D-R, in other word, second word, D-R-A-F-T, Virginia, 24477. Is that correct?
That's correct. And
okay, great.
All right. And I'll autograph the books that people order from me here.
All right. Now, I have seen on, like, eBay, on books and so forth, I've seen your books that are unsigned and used going for hundreds of dollars. One of them was more than $300. So it's incredible that a lot of people don't even know that your books are still in print.
I don't know, because I've never advertised my book, and they've never been carried in bookstores.
Well, for those of you that want the truth, I would strongly urge our listeners to to order Eustace Mullins' book. There's another book that you have. Of course, you've authored many, many books, but there's another excellent book called Murder by Injection, which deals with the AMA.
Of the American Medical Association.
That in itself, Eustace, is incredible that this, to this day, and it's been a while since you wrote the book, but to this day, that Murder by Injection would be the only book written about the history of the AMA. Back after the break with Eustace Mullins. All right, we're back after the break with Eustace Mullins. Now, we have, of course, a common misconception is that the Federal Reserve Bank is printing money. Of course, they never print anything. The money that is printed in the form of Federal Reserve notes is actually printed at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and then it is, after it's printed, it is sold to the Reserve Bank for the cost of printing, which is currently about 4 cents. So the government prints up a $100 Federal Reserve note, and then under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, they have to sell this $100 bill, this Federal Reserve note that they've just printed, to this private bank for the cost of printing, which is about 4 cents. Then it gets even more absurd because in order to pay its debts, the government must then borrow the same $100 bill it just sold for the cost of printing back. It must borrow that Federal Reserve note back at the face value of $100, and in order to borrow it back, it gets even more absurd because the government then must print up a treasury bond, which promises, or bill, or some other kind of debt instrument, which promises on its face to do something that's mathematically impossible. It promises to pay not only the $100 bill, which exists, but also interest, which does not exist. So, ergo, we have the foundation of this model that we're in, which is very similar to the depression cycle of the 1920s to 1930s boom and bust cycle. And in previous programs, I have proven that these cycles are inevitable, not just probable, but inevitable under our current debt money system. And I go back to your book here on page 162, and this is the Mariner Eccles, and he says, before the House Banking and Currency Committee, June 24, 1941, quote, money is created out of the right to issue credit money, unquote, which is just not even printed. That's just a bookkeeping entry out of nothing. And then it's attached in the form of a debt is attached in the form of interest, meaning that from the moment the money is created as a bookkeeping entry, the repayment of that debt is not possible because the principal plus the interest is greater than the principal is issued into circulation. Now, going back to your here on page 162, he says, turning over the government's credit to private bankers of 1913 gave them unlimited opportunities to create money. Federal Reserve System could also destroy money, and this is how depressions are created. I want my listeners to pay close attention to this, because this is how the international bankers create depressions, and it's right in Eustace's book. But to private bankers, the quantities through open market operations, Eccles said at the Silver hearings of 1939, quote, when you sell bonds on the open market, you extinguish reserves, unquote. Extinguishing reserves means wiping out a basis for money and credit issue. I'm reading right from page 162. Extinguishing reserves means wiping out a basis for money and credit issue, or tightening up on money and credit, a condition which is usually even more favorable to bankers than the creation of money. Calling or destroying money gives the banker immediate and unlimited control of the financial situation, since he is the only was shortage. The money panics of 1873, 1893, 1920 to 21, and 1929 to 31 were characterized by a drawing in of the circulating medium. In other words, a contraction in the volume of the money supply. In economics, this does not sound like such a terrible thing, but when it means that people do not have money to pay their rent or buy food, and when it means that an employer has to lay off three-quarters of his help because he cannot borrow the money to pay them, the enormous guilt of the bankers and the long record of suffering and misery for which they are responsible would suggest that no punishment might be too severe for their crimes against their fellow men. On September 30th, 1940, Governor Eccles said, quote, if there were no debts in our money system, there would be no money, unquote. Now, this is incredible. In tomorrow's program, Eustace, I'm going to read from Dr. Pop, whom I'm sure you're familiar with, where he documents how there is, and this is the title of one of his works, there is no need for the U.S. government to incur interest-bearing debts. So your quote here of Governor Eccles, if under the current debt money system there were no debts in our money system, there would be no, is kind of like anti-gravity, is it not?
Oh, it is indeed. And creating money as a debt-bearing currency is the most profitable operation of the bankers. And no one has ever objected to it. Ezra Pound told me in the insane asylum when I met him that you've got to learn the difference between non-interest-bearing currency and interest-bearing currency. And, of course, that was Greek to me, but I did learn.
Okay, I've lost you, Eustace, on the sound. I can't hear a thing right now.
Oh, that's fine. I'm sorry, because that was very important.
Ezra Pound, of course, was the brilliant poet who found out too much about the money system, who was perfectly sane, and whom Roosevelt engineered into the insane asylum in order to try to shut him up.
Oh, yes, he appointed three government psychiatrists to say that he was incompetent.
That is similar to the Soviet tactic during the Cold War of putting political dissidents into the gulag. Ezra Pound was perfectly sane, but he just knew too much. Eustace, I really appreciate your coming onto the program with us, and would love to have you on back again. Do you have any closing comments for our listeners?
Well, we're talking about the most important thing that the American people need to know. John Adams said when he was president that the American people had no knowledge of money or credit, and that's been their drawback all these years. That's why we've had all these depressions and crashes and panics, because the American people never understood the nature of money.
And most of them still don't today.
Pardon?
And I said, and most of them still do not to this day.
Oh, absolutely not. They haven't learned a thing. And my book has been circulating for 50 years, and I've reached a lot of people, but I haven't reached enough.
Again, I would urge our listeners to get a hold of a copy or copies of The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. The subtitle is The London Connection, and I'm holding in my hands the Jekyll Island edition by Eustace Mullins. We read to you earlier about how it's available, and I'll read that address again on how people can order your books. To order Eustace Mullins' Secrets of the Federal Reserve, the price is $40, postage paid, Christian Retirement Home, 94 Mountain Vista Drive, apartment 101, and that's Stuart's Draft, S-T-U-A-R-T, Draft, Virginia, 24477. Thank you once again. I'm the sound is breaking up again, but thank you so much for being back on our program.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be glad to be on again sometime.
All right. We'd love to have you back. Faith, once again.
All right.
Back tomorrow, and we'll be talking about the work of Dr. Pop. There is no for the U.S. government to encourage cigarettes, and he documents why and how the government can wean itself from this terrible debt money system. Welcome back to another special edition of Crash. Are you ready? We have today, back by popular demand, Eustace Mullins. Eustace Mullins wrote a whole series of books on the money system and also about the medical system. And, of course, we were talking in our last interview about the secrets of the Federal Reserve. I reviewed that book again last evening, and it is absolutely superb. It is so head and shoulders above the combination of information and disinformation which is so prevalent among so many of these so-called patriotic books out there. I might add parenthetically, one of the most popular books on the Federal Reserve probably is Creature from Jekyll Island, and it was curious to me when I read the book several years ago that in one of the summary chapters, I don't have the book in front of me right now, but anyway, if you look in the one of the summary chapters, the author Griffin is talking there about the situation in colonial America, and he talks about how the that terrible fiat colonial currency was ruinous for America, and then he says that it was the Bank of England which restored stability to the colony. So it struck me as rather curious that in that particular summary chapter, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, of course, the Bank of England is no more English than the Federal Reserve Bank is federal. It struck me as rather curious that the author of the probably what is the most popular book on the Federal Reserve, The Creature from Jekyll Island, seemed to be praising the very international bankers that the whole book was supposed to be against, because he was lauding the efforts of the Bank of England to quote-unquote restore stability to the colonies. But what he never mentioned was that so-called terrible colonial currency was a debt-free currency, and it enabled the colonies to become the most prosperous area on the face of the earth. The issue of debt money versus debt-free money was not addressed in that summary chapter. Indeed, it was the Bank of England that tried to ruin the circulating medium of the colonies, because the debt-free, non-parasitic money system of the colonies was a challenge to the parasitic debt money system of the international bankers. Well, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, Eustace Mullins' book explains perfectly the difference between a parasitic debt money system and a debt-free sovereign currency. Welcome back again by popular demand. Eustace, are you there?
Of a new book.
Well, tell us about your new book. Now, you mentioned just before we went on the air that you had already written a book years ago, and you personally met the poet Ezra Pound. The title of the older book is called This Difficult Individual, Ezra Pound. Now, Ezra Pound, for the listeners that are not already familiar with Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound was a brilliant poet, probably the most towering literary figure of his era. He, of course, was a contemporary of Ernest Hemingway. And yet, it's interesting because the circles of writers and poets, they all look to Ezra Pound as the number one poet of the era. Those who were contemporaries all look to Ezra Pound for inspiration. And yet today, although Ezra Pound is certainly known, Ernest Hemingway is much better known probably by the average reader than Ezra Pound is. Yet to his contemporaries, Ezra Pound was the author that they drew inspiration from. One of the reasons could possibly be that Ezra Pound found out too much about the money system. He understood the difference between parasitic debt money and debt-free sovereign currency. And Eustace Mullins is one of the few remaining individuals alive today that actually met and worked with Ezra Pound. So, Eustace, could you tell us about your new book about Ezra Pound?
Oh, yes. It's directly attributable to Ezra Pound. Anyway, as I'm the only living protege of Ezra Pound at the present time. All of his Nobel Prize winners, that his proteges got the Nobel Prize for Literature, have passed on. Ernest Hemingway, his most famous protege, became an outright communist and became the darling of Hollywood. And so he made quite a bit of money, but he became an alcoholic and died very soon. He died of suicide, as a matter of fact, so that should be a warning to you. And Ezra Pound never resented him. He called Hemingway him. He never resented the fact that he became a communist. He never complained about it because he realized every man has to follow his own goal.
Well, now, in your studies with Ezra Pound, what are the things that he mentioned about the most important things that he mentioned to you about the money system in terms of what would work and what would not work?
Oh, well, he was perfectly familiar with it all. And the first thing he told me, he said, you have to learn the difference between interest-bearing currency and non-interest-bearing currency. And, of course, that was Greek to me, but I finally learned it.
Okay, what exactly is the difference between interest-bearing currency and non-interest-bearing currency?
Well, it's a religious situation. Interest-bearing currency is the old Babylonian system. It comes straight from Babylon. And, you know, the American army has been tied up in Iraq, the first Christian nation, and is now preparing to nuke Iran, which is the second Christian nation. These are Caucasian people, the origins of our civilization. And we plan to wipe off the first face of the earth. Of course, genocide is illegal under the United Nations, but it can be forgivable if it's for a worthy cause, like wiping out a religious group.
Well, there is an article posted on my website about how the Christians in Iraq are fleeing because under Saddam, Hussein, they said they were tolerated because that was a secular state. But now that the Iraqi situation is fragmenting, you have religious factions persecuting the Christians in Iraq. Back after the break. Welcome back to Crash. Are you ready? We're back with our distinguished guest, Eustace Mullins. Eustace, I remember in reading Ezra Pound's works that Ezra did distinguish. He said not all interest is usury. In other words, an individual who gets a reasonable return on something he has produced Ezra would call that interest. On the other hand, someone like an international banker who gets a return on something he has not produced, he would call that type of interest usury.
Oh, yes. Ezra was a very practical person, and he was not a dreamer, but he saw what was before him. He's very much like another great American, Charles Lindbergh, of course, who, like Ezra, opposed the entry of the United States into World War II to save communism.
Well, now, he said in his writings, he stressed the importance of the local economy. Now, of course, we've had Paul Glover interviewed on our program, who was the founder of Ithaca Hours. It's interesting because Ithaca Hours is a local currency. It's been in existence since the early 1990s, and it works. And this this type of local currency is a debt-free, non-parasitic local currency. It was looked at by the IRS. It was looked at by the Federal Reserve Bank, and what they said was there is no law that prevents the issuance of Ithaca Hours. And so it has been working for years, and indeed this was exactly in the Depression how the cities survived. They issued different types of Depression script. Now, one of the types of Depression script that I ran across years ago was from Mason City, Iowa, and it was very interesting because they were using a type of you had many different types of money or currency circulating during the crisis of the Depression. Of course, the Depression was engineered by the international bankers by artificially creating debt and then contracting the currency. That's the boom and bust cycle. So the cities that survived by issuing their own local currency. And one of the types of local currency, it's the only time I've ever seen it because the surviving examples are rare today, was issued in Mason City, Iowa. And this was a type of currency that was inspired by the works of Silvio Gesell. And what it was, on the back of the currency, you would have stamps that would have to be affixed for you to spend that currency. And if you didn't spend that currency within a certain length of time, you'd have to buy another stamp. So there was an incentive to keep the money circulating. On the back of that currency, every single stamp, stock or stamp, was filled. Which shows me that currency circulated. In other words, it did what it was intended to do, because every place there was for a stamp was filled. Two of the individuals that Ezra Pound was very fond of, one was, of course, Sylvia Gesell, and the other was C.H. Douglas, whose theory of social credit was, again, a non-parasitic theory of the money system. What did Ezra Pound mention to you about these two individuals, specifically Sylvia Gesell and then also C.H. Douglas?
Oh, he talked about C.H. Douglas and social credit constantly. One of the first things he said to me was local credit, local control of local credit. That was one of his maxims. And that was his whole life. He had devoted it to that.
So he understood perfectly, Ezra Pound understood perfectly the difference between a non-parasitic, debt-free, local-based currency and a parasitic international debt money system.
Well, he also understood that all wars are wars to destroy the white race. Of course, it's illegal to mention the white race, because if you do, you're called a Nazi. But the fact is that the white race has the right to survive like any race. And
when we were talking about the money system, Eustace, what did Ezra Pound recommend as an antidote to the parasitic money system of the international bankers?
It goes back to Babylonian debt money 5,000 years ago. This isn't anything new, and people don't understand that It's just an artificial system forced on the world 5,000 years ago. And they've accepted it and said that to them that is money, and it's not money at all. It's a creation of parasitic bankers. And all wars have been fought to uphold the Babylonian money system. That was why Hitler and Mussolini were attacked by the United States, because they refused to join in the central bank system of Europe. Germany and Italy declined participation in the central bank system of the parasitic bankers. That's all World War One and World War Two are about. There's nothing else about it.
Well, in your
Woodrow Wilson said, all wars are economic in origin, because he that meant that they were wars of economic goals.
Well, now in your book, you document how the international bankers pushed and prodded us into World War One. And they provided the, of course, this is typical, they provide the financing for their wars to both sides that they intend to have fight each other. Could you tell us a little bit about how the international bankers maneuvered and facilitated World War One?
Well, they set up central banks in the early 1900s all over Europe and all over the world. And these central banks, see, the first duty of a central bank is to provide war finance. So by setting up central banks, they initiated the era of wars, because the central banks were set up solely to finance world wars. And all these wars were wars against the white race, because the white race...
Well, now, since you mentioned in your book that... The international bankers had facilitated. We'll go back to this topic after the break. We're back with our distinguished guest, Eustace Mullins. Eustace, I would disagree with the idea that the machinations of the international bankers are targeted at any one specific race. I believe there are articles posted on my website about how the international bankers have absolutely raped Haiti, which, of course, is ethnically and racially is predominantly black. They have impoverished Haiti through their manipulations of the international money system. I believe that the international bankers want to make everybody into debt slaves. They want all of us to be debt slaves on the global plantation. They have already put in a large economic trading block in the form of the European Union, with the currency being the euro. The next step that they have planned for us in the debt slavery sequence is the establishment of the North American Union, in which they're attempting to dissolve the borders between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Of course, they realize that they're not going to get their one-world debt slavery system in one step, so as an interim step, they have to consolidate large blocks of economic debt slavery in the form of, now they've got the European Union, now they want to get the Amero going, with the currency's already been, the Amero has already been printed up. They want to get the North American Union going. These are large blocks which will be ultimately be fused into, at least that's their plan, fused into one block, but they can't do it all at once, so as an interim step, they're forming the European Union, they're forming the North American Union. How close, in your opinion, are they to making a reality of the North American Union?
Well, they're kind of closer. They work on it all the time. And That's the thing about these people. They do work all the time. They never quit. They work all night. And their plans go forward because they're so constant in their work. And they have their goals. And the American people have no idea what their goals are or how they're doing it. They get a glimmering now and then, like opposition to the dissolution of the borders of Canada, Mexico, and the United States, but they don't understand what process is going on.
Well, now I'm going to open up this segment to our callers. You have a rare opportunity to ask questions of one of the, or possibly the only, surviving individual who actually worked with the poet Ezra Pound. And again, Eustace Mullins is working on a new book, which of which Ezra Pound will be the subject. Now, you have already published throughout the years several major books on both alternative health and also alternative economics. The title of one of the books that you published on alternative health is Murder by Injection, which, as you mentioned in one of our previous interviews, is the only book written on the history of the American Medical Association.
Yeah, that's why I went to the Library of Congress.
And also your...
And they had no book on the medical association.
Now that is, you have that currently available, the Murder by Injection. Okay. Now there's also the book I'm holding in my hand, which is The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, which is absolutely the best history of the Federal Reserve and what led up to it that I've ever read. The information in it is quite accurate, and it's put forth in a very readable form. In other words, one does not have to have a degree in economics, as I do, to read the book. Any layperson can read this. Any person of ordinary intelligence can extract a wealth of information about how we've been pushed into debt slavery. There are also some, you have some, in addition to Murder by Injection and The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, you also have this difficult individual, Ezra Pound, which is a book which covers your association with the poet Ezra Pound.
It's the only authorized biography of Pound. He personally commissioned me to write this book. And he commissioned the Federal Reserve book, because in his lifetime as a writer, Ezra Pound only commissioned two books from other writers. In other words, his biography and the Federal Reserve book.
Now, you also have some other books. What are the titles of the other books that you have available?
I have one, My Life in Christ, which I'm rewriting at the present time and out of print. And that is the story of my Christian life, and that's my most important book.
Well, now, in order to order your books, you said that the books, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve and Murder by Injection and also this difficult individual, Ezra Pound, you said those were all $40 each postpaid. The other books that you have, such as The Life in Christ, are those also the same price, or are they different prices?
Oh, no, My Life in Christ is not as long a book. I originally published those for $1 a piece in 1968. And they sold out immediately.
All right, so that is that one out of print now?
Yes, it's out of print. I have to.
Oh, okay. So then they cannot order that until it's reprinted.
No, it has to be reprinted. See, I'm in a retirement home, which is the most restrictive area for a publisher to be, because I'm cut off from the world.
Well, now I have your now these books, which are in print and are available: The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, Murder by Injection, This Difficult Individual, Ezra Pound. Eustace, I'll give for our listeners, I'll give your mailing address. These are all $40 each, and that is post postage paid, so that includes shipping. And it's the address for ordering the books is Eustace Mullins, E-U-S-T-A-C-E, Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S, 94 Mountain Vista Drive, apartment 101, that's 94 Mountain Vista, two words, Vista, and then Drive, apartment 101, and the city is Stuart's Draft, that's S-T-U-A-R-T-S, and then another word, Draft, D-R-A-F-T, Virginia, and the zip is 24477.
Yes, so, that's correct.
Okay, now, we have, again, I'm going to open up this segment to callers who might have questions about the money system for Eustace. The number to call is 1-800-259-9231, 1-800-259-9231. Looking at your book here, it's interesting how people are tuning in and listening to today the neocon artists like O'Reilly and so forth, and people of that ilk. How I believe our founding fathers would be turning over in their graves if they could hear the rot that's coming out in the mass media from these neocon artists. I contrast that with at the very beginning portion of your book. This is what is written here. It says, the bill for establishing a national bank in 1791 undertakes, among other things, one, to form the subscribers into a corporation, two, to enable them in their corporate capacities to receive grants of lands, and so far is against the laws of Mort, Maine. I'll continue this after the break. We're back with Crash. Are you ready? We have a caller, Ron in Louisiana. Ron?
Yes, enjoying the program very much. It's very informative. I have a comment to make, and then I have a question also. One thing, he did mention the destruction of the white race. Of course.
Well, now, Eustace is on the line, so you can ask the question, but anyway, we have a situation where the goal of these international bankers is to form a one world debt slavery system, and that means that they want to enslave all of us.
Yeah,
if you go to my website, which is hearitonline.com, that's HEARITONLINE.com, there's a series of articles, one of which is Let Haiti Live. There's several things that you can click on about Haiti and what the international banking system has done to Haiti. Of course, the people,
absolutely,
the population.
I know what you're talking about.
Well, if you haven't seen those articles, it might be even worse than you might think, because what they have done, and of course the ethnicity or the racial composition of Haiti is mostly black. They have absolutely raped that country. They've got the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Did they get there just by chance? Absolutely not. This was deliberately done, and it shows exactly what they did. And this was done by the international bankers to the Haitian people. So it isn't just one group that they're targeting. They're targeting all of us. All of us, and the ultimate goal is to make us all debt slaves in a one-world debt slavery system. In that sense, they don't discriminate. They want to make debt slaves of every one of us. So thank you for the call. And before we went into the break, we were reading from a portion of Eustace's book here. And this was, it's incredible because I was contrasting this from the rot, the absolute garbage that we're getting from the neocon artists, such as O'Reilly, in the mass media today. Contrast this to what is at the beginning of Eustace's book. This is a very distinguished author that is quoted by Eustace about the constitutionality of the bank, the National Bank, February 15th, 1791. Okay, and this distinguished writer is giving his opinion about the bank. It says, the bill for establishing a national bank, which of course was the precursor to the Federal Reserve Bank, the bill for establishing a national bank in 1791 undertakes, among other things, one, to form the subscribers into a corporation, two, to enable them in their corporate capacities to receive grants of lands, and so far is against the laws of Mort, Maine. Three, to make alien subscribers capable of holding lands, and so far is against the laws of alienage. Four, to transmit these lands on the death of the proprietor to a certain line of successors, and so far changes the course of descent. Five, to put the lands out of the reach of forfeiture or escheat, and so far is against the laws of forfeiture and escheat. Six, to transmit personal chattels to successors in a certain line, and so far is against the laws of distribution. Seven, to give them sole and exclusive right of banking under the national authority, and so far is against the laws of monopoly. Eight, to communicate to them a power to make laws paramount to the laws of the states, for so they must be construed to protect the institution from the control of the state legislatures, and so probably they will be construed. I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states or to the people. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible to any definition. The incorporation of a bank and the powers assumed by this bill have not, in my opinion, been delegated to the United States by the Constitution. Now, can any of our listeners tell me who said this? What economist said this? The number to call is 1-800-259-9231. 1-800-259-9231. Can any of our listeners help? Well,
hello?
The distinguished gentleman who said this, and the distinguished gentleman that Eustace quoted in the beginning of his book, is a gentleman by the name of Thomas Jefferson. Now, today, we're not listening to people like Thomas Jefferson. We're listening to the O'Reillys and people of that ilk who are, in my opinion, selling this country down the river. Eustace, would you care to comment on that?
Oh, yes. Thomas Jefferson was a Virginia farmer who knew more about banking than any person I've ever read in my life. And how this Virginia farmer got his information on banking, I have no idea. But he was a very brilliant man and a scholar, and he was also the richest man in Virginia. His father had left him 20,000 acres of prime Virginia land, which today is worth $1 million an acre. And so he died bankrupt, by the way, because the same bankers who he fought against, they finally won over him and left a bankrupt man, and his estate was sold in bankruptcy. So that tells you what happens to people who fight the international bankers.
All right. Now, again, once again, the address to order Eustace Mullins' books. Each one is $40 with shipping included, postage paid, and the primary books that are available are The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, which is probably the best book on the history of the Federal Reserve that I've ever read. That's $40. Then also the only book on the history of the American Medical Association, the AMA, Murder by Injection, that's also $40. And then also this difficult individual, Ezra Pound, is a book about Eustace's personal relationship with probably the most brilliant poet of the 20th century, Ezra Pound. So the address to order those books is Eustace Mullins, Eustace Mullins, 94 Mountain Vista Drive, apartment 101, Stuart's Draft, that's S-T-U-A-R-T-S, Draft, D-R-A-F-T, Virginia, 24477. In the book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, you talk about how the money creators, and I'll just, this is on page 119, on July 25th, 1921, Senator Owen stated on the editorial page of the New York Times, quote, "The Federal Reserve Board is the most gigantic financial power in all the world. Instead of using this great power as the Federal Reserve Act intended that it should, the board delegated this power to the banks through the weight of its influence toward the support of the policy of German inflation." And can you comment about how the connection between the hyperinflation in Germany and the Federal Reserve Bank, Eustace?
Oh, yes. Inflation is simply printing too much money. And the central bank has the right of issue. That is, it can print all the money it wants. And the second task of the central bank is war finance. So since the Federal Reserve Act was, the 1913 was enacted into law, this country has been almost continually at war. And President Bush says he has 97 countries more to attack. So you haven't heard the last of him yet.
All right. Thank you very much for being back with us, Eustace.